Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, and rejoining me is Russ Landy for another episode of Scout Talk. We've had the 2020 NFL Draft and the CFL Draft, conclude this in April, and I thought it would be fun for us to get together and talk a little bit about the draft, talk a little bit about maybe next year's draft, as well as really what happens after the draft when we don't have a global pandemic. So Russ, thanks for coming back on, man.
Of course, man. This is always one of my highlights, is getting to jump on and talk football with one of the brains of the business. And it's funny, we say what normally happens when there isn't a pandemic. Well, the problem is no one can guess what's going on now because everything is new. Everything is completely literally throwing darts at the wall, hoping it works.
Yeah, I mean, it's something else. And I mean, when you talk about, when you talk about that, I mean, certainly that's something that is going to be fun for us to kind of prognosticate or just talk about the potentials there. But just for the sake of the fact that there may be a few of us in this country or in this world who are still in denial, let's have some fun. Let's have some fun talking about what happened in the good old days before exactly. All of this and how this works, so that it gives us at least a baseline to discuss what might happen afterwards.
Well, normally what happens is, in a traditional year, all the scouts and football admin people are in the facility. You host the draft. It's over Saturday. Sunday, you usually come into the office, say, hey, great job. Everybody's excited because every team thinks they did a good job, even though half of them in reality 3 years from now regret most of their picks. And then by Sunday after lunch, everybody's flying home. All the scouts go home, and it's really you get a week or two completely off because you fly back in most situations. You fly back for the rookie minicamp, which is either the first weekend or the second weekend after the draft. We get to see the rookies that you drafted, see the undrafted guys, and also usually see the 10 to 20 or 30 guys you bring in for a tryout. And then after that minicamp, you sort of sort through and say, okay, these are the six guys from the tryout that did well. Let's cut these six undrafted guys we signed, and here's our training camp roster. But obviously that's not happening this year. I have heard that NFL teams are really pushing that if the season does happen, and if there is going to be training camp at the normal time, the week before the training camp, they would like to do a rookie mini camp so they can do that tryout type thing. But I've heard that it's not likely, even though the coaches and GMs want to do that. But after that rookie mini camp, that's when really scouts, that's their time off. I mean, you're home from mid-May until you come to training camp for 10 days and really until mid-August when you go on the road. So you basically have that May to June, June to July, and July to August, 3 months of off time. And your only real job, depending on the organization you're with, is to evaluate the players at the big schools because they want you to have a pretty good feel of just, you don't have to write it. Some teams don't make you write any notes or write any reports. Other teams, you have to write junior reports on them. But more than anything, teams just want you to know who are the players at the major schools that you're going to be looking at. Even though they all get their lists from either Blessed or National, they want the scouts in the area to really be able to take a look, because if, say, Blessed or National says there's six guys at Iowa that are draftable, they need to know as a team, how many people do you as the scout really think are draftable? Because that's going to be how they determine what schools get assigned cross-checkers, what schools are the national scouts going to go to in the fall, things like that. So the summer, you really spend that 3 months doing that. When I was with the Browns, I would do one school a week during that 12 weeks because I had 12 big schools in my area. So Mondays, I would grind all day, get all the film work done, type up a little paragraph on each player, and the rest of the 6 days of the week, I was just chilling and relaxing. And I think most scouts do that during the summer when they're done and away from the facility.
Nice. You know, that's interesting. I mean, it also kind of gives you an idea of how they have to really kind of formulate how this all fits into that scheduling aspect of the scouting role and how important that is. And then, I kind of think the way that you talked about the draft in itself, the funniest thing I kind of came away with that is that Now I picture the draft as like this mass wedding of people in Elvis paraphernalia, you know, and how that they're going to regret their choices in 3 years.
But the worst part was when you would go in on the day after the draft, or sometimes the night of the final day of the draft, usually you'd all have a dinner or meal together, but then you'd all go back to the hotel and two or three people would go to this bar and have drinks. And it was always sort of frustrating when you'd sit there at the draft and you'd be, or after the draft, and you'd be sitting there saying, how did we end up with some of these guys? And you'd literally have this look at you, the two of you'd be saying, I thought the way the board was set, we weren't going to have to draft either one of these two donkeys or whatever you may want to call them. And you're sitting there going, oh my God, this is just going to be a disaster. And it's like, wait a second.
Wow.
Teams spend $4 million a year on scouting, and literally people have regrets that day or the day after. It's sort of scary. And I will say the other thing that you sort of hit on it, because times are a little bit different, is this year, Blesto and National didn't get to complete their spring timing and testing. So the scouts, I'm sure, did all the film work when they got sent home. But my guess is, because the NFL teams generally just want the timing and testing and know what names are at the schools, I would bet the area guys that normally would just take a quick look, I would bet they have to do full reports on all the big schools this summer in order to make sure that their team's like sort of pre-scouting setup is there. So they really know where the prospects are, because I've been told that only about half of the schools were able to get physically tested in time by the Blesto National guys before it was shut down.
So really you're going to have a tougher, for the scouts right now, they're going to have a little bit of a tougher summer or a little bit more demanding summer than what they've had in the past. So that's interesting too, because when you talk about, you know, setting up a schedule and doing work, whether it was normally or in this pandemic mode, you know, I always wondered what it would be like if teams waited to like send like more decision maker oriented, like the lead scout or the head scout, or the director of scouting, some, you know, to the schools and do some of the visits, as opposed to having the entry level guys do or cover territories as much, in terms of part of a strategy of doing that. But I could see how guys might get, if they were to do that schedule, one, it would be different than most NFL teams or any NFL team. And there would have to be, I'm thinking of a rhyme and reason behind that process, but even if there was good process behind it, I could see how a team making that type of adjustment, say they were like for that idea, that they would probably feel behind the gun or like a little bit behind if they were waiting to send like top decision makers to different plays.
Oh, there's no question. And especially because even though you and I, like we joke about, we're sort of we're not the young guys anymore. But you and I are pretty into believing in the technology, believing in the analytics side of things. There are a lot of people, even younger than us, that are working in the league in decision-making spots where they're not going to feel comfortable drafting a guy if they don't get to see him live, at least in the first round or two. So they want to know where to go. They want to have an idea of, hey, when I set my schedule, I need to know, am I going to Georgia versus Kentucky, or am I going to UCLA, USC? So they wanted to know that all ahead of time. The one thing I will say, and this is just something that I thought of as we've been talking about this, because a few NFL people have mentioned this to me, is one team told me, they said, you know, this year we sent 6 scouts into LSU. And and that's not only scouts, directors, GMs, position coaches, all during the season to evaluate players, meet with staff, watch practice. And they sent 5 to Alabama. Both teams told me they think you're going to see either this season or in the near future, teams will go to, hey, we only need one guy to go to each school to physically go there to watch practice and gather the character and intangible information. We don't need to send scouts to every school physically just to watch film and watch practice. And I'm told that travel is going to be lessened, and it's going to really allow the executives to, instead of having to be on a plane all the time, that some of the guys, like a director of college scouting, he may just get to work 80% of it out of his home, just grading the best players on film and really trusting that his scouts are going to gather the character and intangible information And he may, instead of going to, say, four or five schools a week and then a game, he may just go to one school on Friday and a game. So it'd be a lot less travel for some of the higher-ups. I don't think teams will cross-check as much, physically cross-check. Now it'll be, we're going to cross-check on film. We don't need to go to the 12 schools in your area that have draftable players. We're going to trust you got that character stuff. We're just going to do it off film. And what that may do is it may let you spread your area, give you more schools, so you don't have to have as many scouts. You can have more guys above the scouts who are doing additional film work, but maybe you don't need 12 area scouts. Maybe you need 8. So it's going to be, there's going to be some real changes. I know one team has already said these draft meetings via conference call, that is their new thing. They're not going back.
Yeah, I like that. And I think it's interesting because one of the things that I always thought would be kind of fun to watch happen would be the idea of saying, all right, let's do more. I looked at it as more in face-to-face meetings, but they're doing it by conference calls. But having more time to actually have guys watch film together, senior and junior guys watching film together, maybe working on, you know, fine points of what to watch for based on what the team wants from that player. So everybody's really on the same page. And then maybe at the end, instead of having a bunch of guys be information collectors, you know, have them collect whether the guy is good enough to go visit, and then maybe have the senior guy go down and visit and be the one who's has that, you trust that person enough to actually look at character and intangibles and decide whether or not that fits into the equation for what the team wants, as opposed to a 20 something guy who may have no experience, you know, leading, managing, coaching, development, or seen any of that stuff. You know, but you could trust him to watch the tape because he knows something, you know, he's good at watching specific positions and knows about that. And I always wondered if the NFL sometimes got it backwards a little bit because they'd send guys in, as we've talked about, the whole idea of editorializing about character and intangibles. So, but I like, you know, they may not be doing that, but I like the idea that there's going to be more time, you know, maybe where they're doing with these Zoom calls or conference calls, they may start to have the opportunity to say, hey, we have a little more time on our hands. We can do a little more teaching. We can do a little bit more of getting on the same page, you know, and maybe that's, I think it's probably overly idealistic, but I think it's something that maybe some teams will do, maybe be able to find the opportunity to do a little better job of. And as a result of that, we may even see a little better training and development within the ranks on a level where it can be coordinated, and you're not wasting resources, but maybe able to reapply those resources elsewhere. Just hopefully where, you know, it doesn't come to be like what I used to see in state government, which was that if you had a surplus, instead of reapplying it somewhere that was meaningful, it just mean that you weren't going to get that money again.
Exactly.
If you didn't spend it. So I could see how like scouts might feel like state employees.
Yeah,
to
exactly,
a certain
right?
extent.
So here's an idea that I just thought of as we're talking about this. How's this for, to me, a creative way to say, okay, how did this Zoom stuff and conference call work? What if at the end of August, your scouts have done all their big schools, and you put a list together. Here's our top 15 players by position. And during the season, obviously, the coaches don't have the time to sit down and grade them. But what if on Tuesdays, which is players' days off, and generally coaches have a little bit of time, maybe in the morning, or Fridays when teams generally, that's sort of the chill day, everybody's off. What if the coach did a Zoom once a week, one with the number one prospect, then number two the next week, for 30 or 40 or maybe even an hour of each of the top college guys, and you record it and you keep it in your database, and you get that done starting in September, so that the position coach literally at the end of December has spoken to the top 15 guys. Now, that ranking may change. There might be a few late add-ins with juniors, but at least that eliminates the having to chase players down just to do interviews. And your coach can literally say, yeah, didn't like this kid's interview. I think he won't work with my personality. And you can start moving guys off your board during the year based on the discussion. And it won't require that much time. And because of what everybody's going through now, it's going to be second nature. Even older coaches have to know how to get on their computer now and do Zoom. My boss, our GM at Calgary, he's been in his business 40 years. He's getting on his computer doing Zoom and doing WebEx. And it just tells you when you're forced to do it, you can. I think, imagine if every team at the end of December had a database of every coach's interviews, of 200 interviews that all were over 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, it would save you so much time in the spring. And also, imagine you as a GM, you're going on a flight to see a kid live. You just pull up his interview. You can listen on the flight to the one-hour interview with the position coach, get a feel for the kid, get a little bit of an understanding. To me, that would be invaluable.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great idea. And it's anything that you can do, not only just ahead of time, but also to communicate in a way where you can see the ultimate person that's going to be working with these players, what they like, what they need, what the operations side of the business in terms of the coaches on the ground floor, what they're looking for, what's important to the scheme, and yep. to be able to be lockstep with your scouts that way without it having to be a hugely formalized meeting. It can just be something where you're getting instruction about what's needed and you're passing along information, and that's great. And then if scouts wanted to, you could have, you know, if you wanted your scouting director to be able to have something where it's presented once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month, where you're like, okay, we're going to do a position focus and just spend an hour talking about what we look for in the position, just as a review.
Yep.
Or here's what's changed, you know, about the position. What's for, because to me, you know, when I hear someone like Matt Williamson talk about his scouting experience in Cleveland, I said, did you get any training? And he was like, well, they told me I could go into the position meeting rooms, but because I had like 80, 90 hours worth of work to do each week, you know, it was like the priority was getting the work done, which makes sense. But, you know, well, how did you get the job? And he's like, well, you know, they had me watch film. I graded the film. I graded what the players did. I must have done well enough because I got the gig, but how did I do? What are the things that they would have liked to see me do differently? I didn't know that. I didn't get that feedback. So it was like the idea that you could have a little bit of continuous education built into your communication process also is helpful for your younger guys that you bring on, because I talked to somebody who was, you know, who's been talking to a few teams that they've had contacts with in terms of getting into the league. And, you know, one of the teams literally said they didn't really like, you know, three or four of the guys that they had last year in a specific role that was related to scouting. And, it, you know, and that was probably those guys were going to change. But you think, okay, well, what's being done to like proactively see what they know, what they don't know, what's easily correctable. And then what's something that you go, wow, we made a mistake. That was a hopeless decision on our part to hire these people for this role. And I think there's sometimes where we, you know, when we don't know what we don't know, these are people that end up, sometimes you throw people out of the building who might have actually been very good or could have been very good at what they do with just a few points of education and a little bit more time invested into them.
Give you a great point, a great sort of example of that. There's a team in the NFL that, and I want to say it was about 14, 15 years ago, they had a scout who I'm friends with who had been with the team about 4 or 5 years. And I think in 2 or 3 drafts in a row, his grades for DBs were so different than everybody else's. And they couldn't figure, and they were literally on the verge of, should we fire him? Because he was given free agent grades. The guys that went in the first and second round, he was giving huge grades to guys that their coaches and their senior people in scouting thought were barely draftable. And they were really struggling. And he told me he thought that he was going to get fired. And instead of firing him, they said, you know what? When you come back for the rookie minicamp, instead of going home, you're staying here a month. You and the DB coach are watching film for a month. And every day they would sit literally – now, it wasn't 9 to 5 because you're not going to make a guy watch that much film, but maybe 2 to 3 hours a day, they would watch film on DBs and what we're looking for and what also the league is generally looking for to teach him some of the things that clearly he just couldn't either grasp or had never been taught. That month changed him, and he ended up staying with that team for another 15 years since then. And he was already a great person, hard worker, dedicated. He just couldn't get his head around DBs on his own.
And that
a lot of teams would have fired.
And that was a month, right? You said for a month?
I want to say it was a month or 3 weeks where And like I said, it's not like he spent 9 to 5 at the facility working with the DB coach, but I think he said they spent about 2 to 3 hours every day, and they would just watch one player. And it was either a player they currently had, a player in the league, and they also went and watched some of the players that he had been so off on compared to the rest of the scouting and coaching staff. And the coach was like, hey, these are the things we're looking for. The things that you're putting so much emphasis on really don't matter when you evaluate a corner or a safety.
And see, that was probably about 60 hours worth of work, which is like less than a heavy week for a scout.
Yep.
And that changed his career.
Yeah. And think about it. I mean, you and I know from any profession, how hard is it to find the right person in terms of character, work ethic, integrity? They already had that. So why get rid of that person just because he's struggling with something? Why not say, hey, what can we do to make him better at that? Because we know he does everything else right, represents the organization the right way, works his butt off, gets every bit of character information. He just can't grade DBs. And I think it was corners specifically. But they took the time, and even he'll admit to this day, he still struggles with it. Even with all the work, that's still the position he has the most trouble with, but he's not so out of whack with his grades that it's a big deal.
Yeah,
and he's a good employee, so it's like, well, you work with him, and that way you have continuity, which I think is one of the things that's missing in a lot of organizations and why they constantly lose, whereas a lot of teams, like I look at Pittsburgh, are Kevin Colbert and Mike Tomlin the best in the business at what they do? I don't know if they're the best, but they know what they're doing. They are very sort of, you know exactly what you have to do in each of their roles because they've done it for so long and worked so well together that they're able to do a good job year in and year out. And that's part of why they win.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. And it's one of those things that there are some things that you can teach and some things that you can't teach. And even if you do teach a guy, you know, like your colleague who was who's been the 15-year scout, even if you can't teach character at this point.
Yep.
You know, you can't teach some of the intangible things that he may do well at this point. Some of the soft skills that he can't do well at this point, but you can, you know, if you can teach him to be competent at cornerback play, if you can teach him to be competent with some of the things that he was incompetent at, that's a big win. And it's one of those things that I think that's what people forget when it comes to hiring decisions is that, what can you teach someone? What can you not teach them? And if you're having someone read books on emotional intelligence and people skills, and they're 40 years old or 27 or 28 or 30, it's probably too late.
Yeah,
all right.
Exactly.
If their mom and daddy didn't teach them how to be emotionally aware, or they didn't have it in the first place, they're probably only going to get, they're not even going to be competent at it probably later on. You know, some people might, but they're the exception to the rule. So yeah, I love that. That's a great discussion point in terms of just the importance of being able to do that. And yeah, it can, this communication change that we've had during the pandemic could very well foster a little bit more of that. And it's great to hear an example of an NFL team actually taking the time to do that with an individual, because it sounds like a lot of time, but then when you put it in the scope of, yeah, it's less than a work week really over the span of a month, then you're really actually winning. So what happens now, like, at, you know, with the pandemic and the possibility that we either won't have a college season, or as we're hearing right now, which I think is kind of weird, but like every day it's something else weird is happening. So is some teams may be playing, other teams not. What happens if we have a completely odd college football season, either as a non-existent one or partially playing? What are some of the complications you've seen arising from that as someone who's going to be scouting talent for 2021?
Well, I think this year, one of the things that I think is going to be really unique is, and I'm looking at it also from a CFL standpoint, is for CFL teams, we go to NFL training camps to watch their players that may get cut and watch film. NFL teams send their scouts to colleges to evaluate players. Well, what if certain colleges, because of either state rules or the school itself, don't want people that haven't been quarantined and haven't been tested 14 days in a row in their building?
Yeah.
So what if the college football says we're playing but no fans? Okay, so you're playing no fans. Does that mean NFL teams can send scouts into your building, or is that banned? Because what if, I think what you may see is you may see scouts having to do all their film from home this year and spend hours and hours on the phone.
Well, if anybody needs tips, we can.
We can definitely, no doubt. I mean, it could change the scouting profession forever, though.
Yeah.
Think about it. If what they did this spring was one thing, but if they have to go through a whole fall where they can't go on the road and everything has to be a phone and video, and next year's draft doesn't turn out to be a disaster of mistakes, I could see a lot of teams saying, you know what? We're not spending the, whatever it may be, $600,000 a year in travel that we spend for our 8 scouts, or $1 million a year in travel. They may say, we're done with that. We'll travel to see an occasional thing. Maybe we'll spend $50,000 a year, but we're going to save that $900,000, and we're going to give everybody a little raise, and we're going to put the rest in our owner's pocket. But we're going to basically be a lot more chill. And I'll bet you that would also mean scouts have to live in the city of their team, work in the office, watch film in the office. Why go on the road if this is how it's going to be? So that's one possibility. I think the other possibility that's going to be really interesting is if certain schools allow it and other ones don't, in terms of people being allowed in, how do you do that as an organization? Do you send your scouts out and say, well, you only have to cover half your area in person? Or do you say, you know what, we're only going to send out 3 guys and they're going to cover the whole country because we're only allowed into 109 schools, the rest of the scouts who work from home. So it's going to be a very interesting fall. I was just talking to someone today that's outside the league but talks with a lot of people in the league on a regular basis. They told him they expect the NFL to have a season, but they don't expect to see college football.
Yeah. I don't see how they're going to do college football unless Brian Kemp over here at Governor decides that, you know, maybe he thinks this is a plot to take over the rest of the South, and then maybe he opens up the rest of the South here too, but or everybody transfers to Georgia. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe he's a Georgia Bulldogs fan, you know, I don't know. But but the interesting thing to me too is also about the players. If they have a partial season, or like have some teams play but others don't, is that going to mean some players go, I want to play and I want to up my stock. Can I transfer? Can I challenge some transfer rules? Will the NCAA give me some special stipulation for me to transfer from, you know, from say Cal to LSU because LSU is going to open up, or, you know, something like that? Or what about players who are just like, the season's going to start later. And if the season starts in, say, October or say November, or they have a winter season, are there going to be guys like Trevor Lawrence and saying, hey, you know what? I really don't want to have to play from like, you know, January through April and then have to, you know, immediately start all over again, right, with an NFL team. And I'm going to be banged up when I start start my pro career. You know, especially say it's a running back like a Travis Etienne, who's like, you know, I'm going to be banged up and start my career, or, you know, because certainly undrafted guys coming over from the XFL or something like that, maybe they would have had to risk doing that, or, you know, different types of situations like that. But still, when you're high profile and you have an agent whispering in your ear, like, what's the best thing for you, the safest thing for you to guarantee the money you're going to get and be off to a good start, I could see how that would wreak havoc on player decisions. And then there's just the thing that's most compelling to me as a person who is sitting here grinding tape from home is, okay, I guess I'm watching lots of 2019 and 2018 tape on guys, you know, who I don't know if they've progressed or not, and how much am I going to project? And like, that's going to be part of the disaster, I think, because we look at Joe Burrow and we go, yes, there were signs that Joe Burrow looked like he could be a compelling NFL draft pick.
Yeah.
But not the first overall pick, exactly, or even in the top half of the draft. And now, are we going to have, you know, there's lots of guys like that. I'm just thinking skill players, Denzel Mims, Joe Burrow, great example of two guys right there. Devin Asiasi, who got picked fairly early, you know, by Bill Belichick, who certainly looked compelling, you know, this year. And I'm glad that shows that they were watching the film this year and not basing it on production like some media people do. But, you know, it's those types of players that, you know, you might be looking at and seeing snippets of, and I'm interested to see if, you know, we end up in a situation where, you know, teams say, well, we need to send the scouts out to the facilities and see all of this. And last year proved that, when actually what it proved was that you needed 20 tape and didn't have any.
Yeah. And here's the other question. How many kids come out early now? Over 110, 115 a year for the draft. If the college season gets delayed, agents are already talking to kids for next year. If they say we're starting in November, how many kids say, screw that? My agent's telling me I'm going to come out anyway. I'm a third year redshirt sophomore, third year junior. Screw that. And they say, I'm not playing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you could end up with 200 kids that do that.
Yeah.
And then what seniors say they don't want to play. A guy that's had a good career, 2 year starter, a guard says, why am I going to play? You have 2 years of film on me. I'm just coming out. I don't want to risk getting hurt starting in November, finish in February.
Yeah. And then you wonder, then you're going to have these kids who may have made the wrong decision by deciding to do that, and they don't play. And then meanwhile, you get what I call like the Robert Edwards effect, where if you remember Robert Edwards at Georgia, who was just a wonderful player before he got hurt, and then was still a pretty wonderful player in the Canadian League. And when he came back, but I think the NFL teams were kind of scared of that knee. He was someone who, literally, the team just had too many running backs get hurt, so they moved him over from cornerback, and they had no idea what they had in him until he started playing running back. And you could see one of these situations occur for where, you know, say Travis Etienne says, yeah, screw that, I'm not playing. And then, like, maybe there's a couple other guys who aren't either, and they end up moving, like, a promising cornerback or linebacker over to running back. And the guy ends up being great, you know? So we could wind up in a lot of weird situations. And I think the hard part too is, like, with certain positions, you just need that time to see the field enough and experience what's going on in the field to get a feel. And that's quarterback. So if a senior misses his entire year, you know, not playing quarterback in the NFL, do we look at this class that we were found so prompt? You know, a lot of people find the whole idea of Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence very promising, or a Matt Corral or JT Daniels. And you start to wonder, like, well, if they have a year, maybe year and a half, where they haven't played at all, do we suddenly downgrade these guys because the developmental curve wasn't there? And I wonder which teams decide to look and say, we're not picking quarterback this year. You can forget that. I don't care how good this guy looked. It's too much of a risk. Where other teams say, we're going to give it a shot because we liked what we saw. And which team's going to be right about it? And will it, and it probably will come down to individual situations, but we can see how the media will look back on this and cover that as well and say, well, you know, all the analysts thinking, should they have drafted them at all or not? Because if I were running a team, I'd probably look at it and go, I don't think this is the year that I want to be drafted a quarterback.
Yep. But here's the other thing. So say the NFL plays, because I think they're going to try. The NFL is going to come hell or high water.
Yeah.
But say college football can't, because there's too many risks, too many potential lawsuits, so many different things. In January, does the NFL say, you know what? Normally we have the senior, we have the East-West, and there's the NFLPA. We're going to add 4 more senior bowls. And we're going to get every kid in there also. Or would the NFL maybe say, we're going to do the All-Star games, we're moving the combine up, draft is mid-February, because we want to get all these kids who have been on the field in a year and a half, we want to get them going through OTAs starting March 1st or starting February 20th so that they can get back into football shape, both mentally and physically, to be prepared for training camp after not doing anything for a year and a half. So, I mean, there's so many unknowns. It's a crazy situation.
Yeah, that is crazy. And just the idea of them having a draft in February, I'm just sitting here thinking, wow, I better get to work right now.
Yeah, no doubt. You're going to be like, oh, my head hurts.
That's kind of where I'm like right now. I'm going, okay, so do I want to still be? I got to get on the stick. But yeah, it's that it is. It's a fascinating look at all of this, because then you know you start thinking, and then also like all the guys who may slip through the cracks, and it's just the that's the hard part about all this, is I love the ideas of how things might get better, but I can also just see right away, as the pessimist in me, is like, I can see us all over analyzing the situation, you know, people analyzing the situation incorrectly and attributing it blame to fault to wrong things, and then giving it reason to keep doing the same dumb stuff we've been doing before, you know, one way or the other. But speaking of like the draft, I mean, let's round this out and talk a little bit about, you know, any draft day observations you had that you liked, whether it was, and we could even add free agency to that, you know, free agency moves, draft moves, whether it was trades, draft day trades, UDFA pickups, you know, fits that you really like. They can be all on the, they can either be, you know, high profile guys or guys who are just kind of a little bit later on.
Well, firstly, the thing, and it's funny, I think you and I have talked about a bunch, the thing that everybody's been discussing, why did Green Bay draft Jordan Love, and was it a mistake, and what's it going to do to Aaron Rodgers, and how good is Love? And to me, it really comes down to the basic, simple thing. And mind you, I don't like Love. I think he's going to struggle with consistency in the NFL. I don't know if he'll ever be good enough to be a starting quarterback. That being said, I love the move, because my belief is it's always better to draft a quarterback and try to develop him when you got one, as opposed to San Diego with Tyrod Taylor saying, yep, guess we're drafting Justin Herbert, who I think is a quality quarterback, and guess what? We're going to try to start him with 4 days of prep work because there's no offseason this year, and we're going to try to throw a rookie into the fire. Whereas if they had, say this had happened a year ago, and they had drafted a bear a year ago, and he'd had a year to sit, not that having the time to sit guarantees you're going to be better, but at least it gives the team the option of not having to rush him in. And that's why, even though I don't love Love, I think there's a lot of value, and the Patriots did this year after year, of always bringing in a quarterback. Basically, every other year in New England, you drafted or signed a free agent. That's what I like that Green Bay did. They said, we're not going to get caught with no plan. Our plan is, we think this guy can be a quarterback, and if their whole organization believes that, and they can go get him, and Aaron's 37 this year, this kid could sit for 2 or 3 years, and they're not going to be caught with their pants down. So I love that move. I think it was a bright move. Like I said, whether or not I like Love, I think if they liked him, then it's a smart move on their part.
I like that view of it, because it's, you know, it kind of sheds some light on another aspect of this whole thing, because you could say, you know, there's part of me that when I looked at it as from the viewpoint of, well, if this team's trying to, like, you know, the leadership here is trying to win now, or the leadership is trying to say, you know what, Aaron, we want to take back control of this team on a certain level where, you know, and I don't want to say that Aaron Rodgers has control of the team, because I think that's a little hyperbole there, but he's one of the main leaders of the team.
Oh, yeah,
for sure.
No question.
Yeah. So if he's one of the main leaders and they don't like the fact that he's one of the main leaders, and that's an issue, then certainly you need to draft a guy early enough to prep him so that you can let Aaron play out the string. And I think that makes sense, because there's a part of me that when I looked at it and I thought, well, if you didn't like Aaron Rodgers and you wanted to piss him off a little bit, this would probably be the way to do it. But at the same time, you could have just avoided all of this and maybe traded him and brought another guy, but you're setting your team back even further than you needed to. And so I can see in theory, while I think you and I would agree that it would have been fun if they drafted Justin Herbert and let him sit a year behind Aaron Rodgers.
No question.
that would have been a whole other story. But the move in a vacuum, I totally agree with you on that. But I also like that they did add a back in Green Bay and Anthony and AJ Dillon, who I think can consolidate that backfield a little bit if they decide to move on from Aaron Jones, because maybe they feel a little uncomfortable with his ability to stay healthy. And Jamal Williams, as good of a back as he is as a reserve or a contributor, he just doesn't quite have that burst or pop to really be your lead back. And I think that AJ Dillon kind of consolidates those two backs into a guy that can be a starter down the line and really even threaten it to be a high-end contributor this year. And if they're going to mold the offense in an image where they feel like they don't need Aaron Rodgers to carry the water for them, and they can kind of spread it around a little bit more. I get that in terms of the idea of doing it, even if I'm not, you know, even if I don't agree with it, I understand it.
In terms of he doesn't have the weapons, but I get what they're trying to do, which is we don't want Aaron to have to do everything.
Yeah.
We want to take a little bit of pressure off him. Totally understand it. I would just love to have some more guys catching the ball, but you know what? That's part of the game. Each team's going to, or organization's going to have a philosophy of the quarterback is the one who makes the receivers, so we don't have to go get receivers. We're going to get ball carriers so we can take the pressure off.
Right, right. So, you know, another team, one of the teams that I liked, and I, you know, in terms of, you know, one of the moves that I particularly liked, and it was interesting to me, was late, speaking of another running back, was Eno Benjamin being drafted late by the Arizona Cardinals. I mean, what I liked about that is that they have a spread scheme. You know, Kenyon Drake has improved as a player. When he first got drafted by Miami, as early as he did, I thought, wow, he's going to need a couple of years because he only runs gap. And his footwork really needs a lot of work. And you'd see him for the first couple of years in Miami where he'd end up like knocking himself on his ass because he'd jump cut his way into the backside of linebackers or of linemen because he didn't understand how to react to penetration or to defenders covering gaps without making dramatic movements. And, you know, working with Frank Gore, having Frank Gore as a teammate, I think he's talked about that helping him. And you could see that he actually took it seriously and really refined his footwork and became a pretty good back. And I think that, you know, the Cardinals picked guys, they were able to wait for a guy like Benjamin, who I think has that ability to function very well in a spread offense, catches the ball well. He has enough contact balance that I think he could be a lead back for a scheme like this. And he fell. And I think he probably fell probably due to his size, probably due to the fact that he fumbled the ball 7 times last year. When he didn't fumble, he had very few fumbles throughout most of his career. And then there may be some things behind the scenes that we don't know about with him that dropped him a bit. But from what I could tell on film, it seems to me like he's a guy that could be even an upgrade to a guy like Chase Edmonds, who I liked, but he could wind up being a late round gem for them. And
I couldn't agree more. I think his fit is perfect.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, and then you take a look at who they backed him. There's a guy they got, the Jonathan Ward guy I talked about, when I think we've talked about on this show. They took him as an undrafted free agent. So they clearly picked the right guys in terms of the type of player they're looking for there. So that's another one that I like. How about, is there another move for you that you particularly, that comes to mind?
Yeah, I mean, the team that to me, and this wasn't one particular player, but it was their philosophy. When Minnesota got offered all those picks by New Orleans, and they said, yep, we'll take it. We'll take 11 picks on day 3 because we're not going to get into the fact that we have 17 scouts and coaches in their own homes trying to talk to 43 different agents and players and parents to convince them to sign with us as undrafted guys. What we're going to do is we're going to have 6 picks in the final 2 rounds. So we are taking 6 undrafted guys, and we're going to give them each basically about $30,000 to $40,000 more in a signing bonus, but we're getting every top priority free agent we want. And I thought it was a brilliant move in a draft in a year that is so unknown because you didn't get to work out a lot of these kids. Kevin Colbert was the one who came out and said he thought they should have added 3 rounds to the draft because you don't have workout numbers, so there may be a higher failure rate. And the Vikings just said, you know what? There may be some truth to that. And who knows if that even came into their thought process, but I do think it played a factor in it. And they said, you know what? We can move a little bit. We drop from the 3rd to the 4th, and we pick up 6 picks, and we end up with 11 picks on the final day. To me, it was a no-brainer, and it really allowed them. When you look at some of the guys they were able to take a shot at, whether it's Josh Metellus, the safety from Michigan, Kenny Wilkes, the defensive end from Michigan State, Nate Stanley, the quarterback we had talked about from Iowa. These are some highly productive major college guys that had one or two things that you really looked at and said, yeah, I don't think they're going to make it. But you know what? In the 7th round, to throw a dart on a kid like Nate Stanley, who arm strength-wise, no question it's there. He has a decent release, and he's a better athlete than you think. Well, in the 7th round, Of course he's a great value there. Whether he ever makes it or not, you don't know. But I love that the Vikings said, you know what, we want more picks on day three to go get guys so we don't have to get in bidding wars. Let's go get the top guys we want so we don't have to worry about, oh, we ended up having to take the third quarterback because our top two went to Miami and San Diego.
Yeah, no, I love that. A guy who, you know, speaking of free agents, a guy that I kind of really liked his landing spot was a guy that everyone was talking about as one of the top tight ends in this class, like this time last year, all the way through September. And he went undrafted, I think, or he was drafted late. And that was Jared Pinkney. And when you think about the fact that Hayden Hurst gets, you know, he gets sent to Atlanta, and certainly he's a nice athlete. He catches the ball well in stride, and he's someone that can make big plays for them in what Atlanta likes to do in their passing game, which is kind of hit those guys in the flats and let them run a little bit. But in terms of seam work, in terms of blocking, being a really strong H-back, I'm sure I haven't really evaluated his blocking a ton, but I remember it wasn't something that stood out highly for me. Whereas when I looked at Jared Pinkney, I really liked what I saw from him as a blocker and his potential to work both as an H-back and an inline guy. And though he's not fast at all, he has just enough burst and he's fluid that he can work up that seam. And I can totally see him in a situation in Atlanta where he could vie for a starting spot if Hayden Hurst struggles a little bit, or at least be a good contributor who can play that second tight end role in two tight end sets and be good as a lead blocker, be good as a guy up the seam against zone. Like, to me, he has starter caliber receiving skills against zone coverage. It's the man-to-man stuff that you have to worry about with him further down the field. But to get him that late, and you know, they have right now their tight end crew, like their most notable two tight ends are basically move tight ends who don't really work that well in line, at least from what I saw. So Pinkney to me was a really nice addition.
Yeah, I like it a lot also because if you look at what their offense does, they do a lot of misdirection where they have someone swing out and block on the move. Well, this is a situation where you can let Hurst go out and be the pass catcher. This guy be the guy you move, let him block on angles, and also let him just be the flare out guy. We're going to send Hurst down the field. This guy can just go do a 3 yard out to the flat. Boom. There's a guy you can go to in case of emergency. He's a strong physical player, very smart, knows what he's doing in terms of not only can he physically make the blocks, but he knows his positioning, understands where he has to be. I think it's a great fit for the Falcons. I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up their number two tight end and playing almost every game, 20 or 30 snaps, whenever they go with two tight ends, because he's a guy I could see being a valuable part of that offense, even if he only catches 7 balls in the season.
Yeah. Let me add one more guy, and then I want to hear what you think as well, or really two. But the first one I'll add, and then I want to hear your next guy, is Anthony Gordon, the quarterback from Washington State going to Seattle. I know Will Hewlett, who worked with him this offseason, who's part of the quarterback collective, former Stanford quarterback. And he said that everyone he's dealt with, who's dealt with Gordon, as well as his dealings with them, they just feel like this kid intangibly has what it takes to become a starter. He has to really work on his footwork more than anything and probably add some weight, you know, get a little bit more, you know, durable in terms of his size to be able to take some of the punishment in the league. But a guy with, you know, a good release, excellent release, and some anticipation that you can see notable on certain types of routes. Very good at seeing, you know, sideline to sideline of the field. I think he's better at seeing the width of the field more than he is at the depth of the field right now. But there's some promise there with his game. And get him sit behind probably who's been one of the most durable young quarterbacks in the NFL, because he's no longer really considered a young guy, and Russell Wilson. And you could see how Gordon would be a guy that maybe in a couple years they might have something in him. So I like that addition of him because he gets time to sit, and there's a little spark to his game. It would be fun to see how much they can ignite it.
Well, and I also think the other thing is, anytime you have a quarterback like a Russell Wilson, who we all know he's great, we all know he's ultra competitive, but any player who's achieved that level of success, there are going to be days where it's just not going to be there in terms of in practice. He's not going to have that fire. Well, when you have a little spitfire like Gordon, every day comes because A, he's young, and B, he just has that little edge to him. He's going to get Russell, I think, not only to want to compete more, not that Russell doesn't compete, but on those days where maybe he doesn't, but I think it's just going to be a great challenge because I think some of the things he does are a little bit different than what Russell does, and some of them he may do better. His ability to be accurate on some of the real quick-hitting stuff, he may push Russell to do a little bit more and to say, you know what, let's try a little bit of different things. So I think it's a great fit, and I can give you two players I also think that I thought were great fits. All year we also talked about the and I'm not even going to try to pronounce his last name, but the tight end from Missouri, Albert.
Yeah, we'll call him Chuka. That's his nickname, is Chuka.
Okay, there we go. Think about a year ago, people are saying he's one of the best tight ends in the country and he's catching passes from Drew Locke at Missouri. Well, now he comes into the NFL and he's going to catch passes from Drew Locke with the Broncos. So I think there's a chance for the inconsistency, which a lot of people were frustrated with in this kid's career, in that he wasn't the dominant player all the time that he should have been. I think he only had 26 catches this year. I think him going out there to Denver, being with Drew Locke, Drew probably has a little bit of an idea of what makes this kid tick. I think it could be a chance for Denver to really score with this kid. And I give also the Chargers credit. Even if you love or hate the Justin Herbert pick, to me, trading up to get the linebacker Murray is a great pick because this is a guy that I think only fell because he had the hamstring and couldn't run a 40. So people were a little nervous to pull the trigger, even though every team I spoke to said, slam dunk, he's a first-round linebacker. So I think the Chargers were aggressive there. And later in the draft, they took a kid that I think we had talked about and we both sort of thought was interesting, is the receiver K.J. Hill out of Ohio State. Yep. Because when you watch Hill play, all he does is get open. He can sell guys. He can fake guys. He gets out of his route. The problem is he's tiny. You can eat peanuts off his head, and he's not a fast kid. He's a quick little receiver who runs great routes. He's super tough. He has natural hands. But he's a midget, and he can't run. So, of course, he's going to fall on draft day. But I could see him being a guy who ends up being a contributing player on the team because that kid just gets open. No matter who's covering him, he finds a way to get some space.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. And I think that that makes perfect sense, you know, and being able to trade back and get a quality player like Murray. And yeah, and he'll, you know, oftentimes it is. It's about having smart receivers, especially in terms of what you do in the slot. And if that allows him to move Keenan Allen around a little bit more, if he's a guy that they can use in the slot a little bit more and put Allen on the outside at times, that can be helpful. So yeah, I like that. You know, guy who I think is kind of in a sink or swim situation, and I don't know if it's going to help him or hurt him, but I would say it's more of a like, we're going to find out quickly. And I think that's Jake Fromm in Buffalo, because, you know, with him, the big concern was the arm talent, the velocity. And now that he's going to a town where it's going to be like, well, son, you better do it. Like you better show improvement with that arm right away. And if you don't, well, you know, you're going to be elsewhere. And if you're elsewhere, other teams are probably going to label you not strong enough with the arm to do the gig. And they may not give you as close of a look, you know, when it comes to you competing and getting reps and training camp and things like that in future years. Whereas if, say, he landed in New Orleans and he had a couple years to sit behind Breeze, and then they threw him out there to see if the arm talent was enough really in pivotal situations, he either would have had time to improve, or if he didn't, the team already would have invested in him enough that he would have gotten that kind of shot. Whereas I think in Buffalo, it's like, we're going to see it maybe in the preseason. If we have a preseason, we may see it at the end of the year. If, say, the Bills are either out of it, or if the Bills have earned a bye and then they can put Fromm in and there's no injuries to Allen, which, of course, that can be a risk too with Allen's kind of style of play, that Fromm may have a chance to get in there if he can beat out Matt Barkley, you know, which is another if as well. But if presuming that he does or he gets the nod, then we're going to, I think we're going to find out fairly soon if Jake Fromm's going to have, he knows right now. I mean, if he isn't aware right now that what he's going to be dealing with in terms of weather and his arm talent, then he's about to get a rude awakening and a career threatening one. And I don't think he's that unaware. I think he's super aware.
Oh no. I think he knows mentally. I think he knows exactly what's going on. I think to me, the oddest part is if you look at that team, Josh Allen is so different than Barkley and Fromm. To me, it's a very odd situation. And I think what's going to be unique is when, not that they're going to supplant Allen, I'm not saying that, but I think it's going to be very interesting to see in practice, their offense, even though it's going to be the same offense, it's going to look very different when the two quarterbacks are in there, because Allen obviously is the big cannon who can make those rip 18 and 22 yard throws down the field. Fromm's not that guy. Fromm's going to be the quick, the ball is out, boom, we're going the 7 yard slant, the 4 yard out, whatever it may be. I think it's going to be a very big contrast. And I think the other interesting is if, and I think it's beneficial for Fromm, if, although the NFL says they're going to start on time, if things get delayed at all and that preseason gets shrunk and Fromm, and because of that, they maybe get 10 days of training camp at one game. Teams are almost going to be hesitant to cut their draft picks unless they are so abysmal. And that will give Fromm a year to not only adjust to the NFL, but to work with, not that he didn't have good strength coaches there at Georgia, I'm sure he did, but now he's going to get specific training, if they feel he needs it, to work on his arm. If when they get him out there, they think his arm is lacking, this will give him a year to do that. Because I can tell you, when Brady was a sixth-round pick, I remember a scout from the Patriots, who's now a high-level executive with another team, saying that after Brady's first year, there were still doubts as to whether he would ever improve his arm enough to become a quality starter. And obviously, he did the work to improve that arm strength. So can Fromm do the same sort of thing if they have a short training camp where he's almost forced to make the team? I think it could be very beneficial if he is sort of stuck into this situation of having to be there, if only because he was drafted in a weird year.
Yeah, and what's funny is you can see how this situation might play out for Fromm in a positive way, where in training camp it may not look as impressive to the media because they look for the big throws and the cannon, you'd be able to hit these impressive plays that are very obvious. But where it may show up more impressively for Fromm could be in game situations, if he had to take over for a struggling or hurt Allen and defenses are blitzing the hell out of Fromm and you see him making quick, strong decisions and moving the team up and down the field. And then suddenly you're going to say, it may not have looked great to the beat writers in practice, but the team's going to go, oh, we feel great about Fromm because we know he's going to move us up and down the field. He's going to put the ball in the hands of our playmakers, and it's just going to be up to us to do the work, as opposed to, you know, Josh Allen, who may be more apt to like do 8 million different things and then put a ball in a situation where the receiver has to make a tough play, but he doesn't have much room to do much else other than just hold on to it and hope for the best.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a unique situation because he and Allen are so different, but I think it really could be a beneficial one. Because I think it also, maybe it gets Fromm to see some of the things that make Allen special, that willingness to gamble, the willingness to not always take that quick, boom, I got that throw. Maybe I wait a second longer. And maybe that will influence Fromm a little bit, because I personally think the arm is there.
Yeah.
From what I saw in film, I think it's there. I think sometimes the conservativeness of how he played within Georgia's offense makes you question if he believes his arm is there. And I think maybe this gets him out of that shell a little bit. I'm very excited to see how he does, because I think they have a great coaching staff. They have a lot of young talent. This is a team that I think could really benefit from having a guy, whether Fromm is the ideal backup or maybe potentially long-term takes over. But someone like him there, I think he's a real benefit to that team, and I think it's a great fit, even though it's an odd one.
Yeah. Let's end this on one note here with a guy that we both kind of talked about how much we liked earlier in the year. And I've certainly been on a show or two talking about him, and we talked about him on the first night of the draft, and then he went in the second night, and that's Grant Delpit. What do you think of that?
You know, it's funny. After that happened, I texted a buddy of mine who works for a team, and I said, what happened? I said, when I did the film on this kid, and I said, most of the film I did was 18, not 19. I said, I loved the kid as an athlete, loved him in coverage. I said, I understood there were concerns that he was an inconsistent tackler. And his response to me was, hey, he goes, if it were just inconsistent tackling, it wouldn't be the question. He said, when we graded him in our draft meetings, he said, we actually felt he was going to hurt the team in run support, not just make mistakes. They just felt he was so unwilling to come up and engage that he would be a negative to their team in run support. So that, to me, is going to be the great challenge for him, is if he can sort of say, hey, it wasn't that I wasn't willing, it was what I was sort of asked to do, and this is what happened. If he can become just adequate against the run, I think you're talking about a guy that we both feel, at least we did during the season, that coverage-wise, athleticism-wise, instincts-wise, he's got a lot of the tools to be an elite coverage safety. And I really think he could blossom in Cleveland as long as he steps up and becomes at least an adequate guy against the run to where he's not going to hurt you, to where coaches won't keep you on the field. And he benefited, I will say, if he had slid further into the fourth round, that would have been a real disaster, because when you get down to fourth round, you have to be a contributor on special teams to make the team. Now that he's a second rounder, he doesn't have to go out there and knock people's heads on special teams, which if your concern was that on defense against the run, he wasn't going to go out there and do it on teams, would be your guess based on what you're seeing on run support. Now he doesn't have to do that. He's going to be in Cleveland for 2 years. Now's his chance to prove he can be a quality safety.
I love it. No, that was a great perspective. And I like getting a chance to hear, you know, what was thought within maybe an NFL room in terms of also in terms of what they were concerned about with him. I'm going to go back and watch some of that myself. Well,
I
listen,
didn't see it personally. I thought, were there missed tackles and things like that? Yes. But I still saw a dynamic athlete who in coverage was so special that I would put up with an occasional missed tackle and being out of position here and there against the run, because to me, he was that safety you could bring down on a slot receiver. And that in today's NFL is so valuable. I'm interested to see how he does. I hope he turns into an all-pro.
Yeah, because when I watched him, one of the things I had as notes was how good he was at coming up the alley to make a play. So that's kind of why I want to go back and just see if there's anything that I missed or that adds color to that, because I could certainly see from the tackling perspective, especially last year.
Yes.
But last year with the sprained ankle, with the high ankle sprain, I mean, to me, I've joked around that it's like this, you know, Roddy White was a great route runner in the prime of his career, who he and Matt Ryan were pretty much automatic, whether he was bracketed or outright doubled man to man on timing routes, third and 15, third and 16, you know, Ryan didn't care. I mean, he would hit Roddy White pinpoint. And then when you put Roddy White, you know, Roddy White has an ankle, high ankle sprain and tried to play on that. He was basically, you know, a poor imitation of Anquan Boldin at the end of Bolden's career, you know, just kind of sitting down in the open zones. And that's about all he could do on the field. And I'm thinking, even if you're a young man playing with a high ankle sprain, you're not going to be able to move and adjust that way with the precision that you need to do as a tackler in open field or as a route runner, the way that a route runner would have to do the same stuff. So I saw that and I thought, I'm kind of writing that off, but it will, nonetheless, we're about to find out.
Yep.
And listen, you know, on behalf of Russ and I, we appreciate you guys, you know, listening to the RSP Scout Talk podcast. You can find it on iTunes. You can find it on Google Play, pretty much every outlet that you would look for a podcast. The RSP cast is available. You can find Russ at Russ Landy. You can find me at Matt Waldman on Twitter, and the RSP post draft is available now. So if you are a fantasy player and you like getting a chance to, you know, have a cheat sheet that's going to take one person's rankings versus the average draft position of several different leagues and kind of find where the sweet spots are to draft these players for value, you know, you get that with the RSP along with depth chart analysis. And of course you get the pre-draft with it, which has a nice, you know, I would say, how would I put it? A nice shelf life for like 1 to 3 years as well.
Oh,
for a lot of those, one of those guys plays later. Yeah. So you get all of that plus a newsletter and rankings that'll be updated 3 times a year for $21.95. You can check that out at mattwaldman.com. Thanks again for listening, folks. On behalf of Russ and I, you guys have a good week.